Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. It's a day we talk about the management of ER-positive and triple-negative breast cancer with Dr. Sarah Hurvitz from the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA in Los Angeles. We have a great faculty for this series, and later on we'll show you the results of a survey of the faculty of their usual treatment practices. As in all of our webinars, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to see discussed, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We're putting out a very quick one-minute survey at the beginning of this program, and at the end, if you take it, you'll get a lot more out of the program. We'll learn a little bit more about you. We do webinars all the time now. Coming back tomorrow night, same time, same place. We're going to talk about papers over the past year in immunotherapy, another non-targeted approach to lung cancer. We'll see what Dr. Wakeley and Pazaris think about adjuvant and neoadjuvant IOs and many other controversial topics. We also are doing a year-in-review program on colorectal cancer. We'll be doing that on the April 19th. We're also heading out for our annual visit with the ONS Oncology Nursing Society. We're actually doing 10 symposia there in about 2 weeks in San Antonio for the nurses here and those that you know. Please, if you're in the San Antonio area, stop on by. You're going to ONS or check it out online. We're going to be covering a lot of things. We've got about 40 faculty we're bringing to San Antonio. The next day, we'll be at the AUA meeting also in Chicago. We are doing 2 symposia there on the following day after ONS, one on bladder cancer, so much going on there, and then prostate cancer that night, Sunday, April the 30th. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars, you know, while they're driving or working out. If you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program with Drs. Mayer and O'Regan on ER-positive disease. But today we're here to talk about HER2-negative breast cancer, so triple-negative and ER-positive. As always, we have a bunch of docs in practice who are eager to get some feedback on cases. We actually have 12 cases. I don't know if we're going to get through all of them. This is the last one of these in this series, so we'll see if we can. We're going to start out just before we get started with the cases and talk about the topic of ADCs, antibody-drug conjugates in breast cancer. Then we'll get into the cases, and we'll also show you the results of the survey we did of the faculty. Here are the cases, a bunch of interesting scenarios that we're just going to get Sarah's top-line input on. But I want to just start out with the whole idea of antibody-drug conjugates. And you did this great paper in Nature Cancer looking at antibody-drug conjugates in general in cancer. And, you know, so many, I feel like we talk about it almost every day. There are 2 approved in bladder cancer. Both of them are used often sequentially. First-line therapy for Hodgkin's for a while now has had an antibody-drug conjugate, bevacizumab. Diffuse large B-cell, looks like maybe polatuzumab is going to come in first-line. Cervical cancer, tisotumab, vedotin, endometrial cancer, mirvetuximab. So, Sarah, a lot of action going on in terms of ADCs. Any comments on this strategies? And do you kind of generally review at least the ADCs that we're doing now as sort of a form of chemotherapy?
Yeah, actually, it's really amazing to see how far we've come when you consider that 23 years ago with Mylotarg, we were greatly disappointed when that drug ended up having so much off-target toxicity that the FDA withdrew its approval. And my, how far we have come now with these third or fourth generation ADCs. But I do think that some of the ADCs that have made the biggest splash recently are somewhat like chemotherapy. They're getting the chemo into the zone of the tumor and exerting its effects, but it's not this original idea where the chemo is confined to the tumor, sort of the way that trastuzumab emtansine was. T-DXd has a lot of off-target effects, which is leading to enhanced efficacy, actually, as does sacituzumab govitecan. So I think it would be wrong to say that these are entirely targeted to the tumor.
So, yeah, there are a couple of sort of unexpected things that came out of T-DXd. One, of course, was the DESTINY-Breast03 study. I don't know that I've seen another study that showed one ADC is better than the other, and in this case, a lot better. So we're talking about T-DXd versus T-DM1, a drug that we were all excited about, and now we see T-DXd blowing it out of the water. Any thoughts about what it is, at least in this situation, that you're getting greater efficacy? Is it the payload? Is it the target? What do you think is going on here, Sarah?
Yeah, I think probably it's multifactorial. I think the payload that's being used is a payload that is unique. Most patients are not treated with topoisomerase 1 inhibitors, whereas patients with breast cancer are commonly treated with microtubule poisons, which is the payload of T-DM1. Moreover, T-DM1 is the benefits are highly dependent on high levels of HER2 antigen expression on the cells, whereas with T-DXd, you don't need as high an expression of the HER2. So if you have a slightly lower expression of HER2 on the cell surface, the drug is still able to exert its effects due to its off-target or bystander effects owing to the membrane permeability of the cytotoxic payload.
And the other, again, sort of macro lesson that we learned about these agents was, you know, the HER2 low paper, you know, really groundbreaking. You did the editorial in the New England Journal. Again, this is paradigm shattering. Here are a couple comments you made in the editorial. The implications of the results of DESTINY-Breast04 are difficult to overstate. These will undoubtedly translate into a new therapeutic option for nearly half of patients with a diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer, an extraordinary finding. And these results should inspire scientists to begin the rigorous yet clinically important translational. But you do a lot of papers, incidentally. I was going, your CV is incredible, including efforts to accurately identify. You have like a publishing house there. These patients are most likely to benefit. We have a case of HER2 low that we're going to present to you, a patient who got T-DXd. But anything you want to say about your thoughts when you first saw the data and you were trying to put this editorial together?
Yeah, when you're writing an editorial, you, of course, want to be think about it critically and take the devil's advocate point of view. It's hard with that study. That was very challenging because the data were incredibly impressive. I mean, it received a standing ovation when it was first presented at ASCO. It deserved a standing ovation. But there are some things that we need to consider and sort through relating to how to best identify patients who are most likely to respond. And I'm not convinced that the immunohistochemical assay is the best, the most sensitive way for us to identify patients who should be treated with this drug. We also have to look at things like ILD rates and how can we mitigate that side effect and how can we mitigate the side effect of cardiomyopathy? Because remember, in HER2 negative breast cancer, anthracyclines are used commonly now in the curative setting. That's not the case in HER2 positive breast cancer. And so the slightly higher rate of cardiac events in this trial may have been related to pretreatment with anthracyclines at a higher rate in the patients who went on this study. That's yet to be reported, but I'm interested in looking at that.
Yeah, that was a surprising part of your editorial. You had a whole bunch of stuff on cardiac effects that I wasn't even aware of. Really interesting. So incidentally, I can't resist quickly throwing by a case that just came into the chat rooms from Smitha, because anytime it starts out 86-year-old, I like it. So locally advanced ER-PR positive, HER2 low, progressed on an AI, now progressing on fulvestrant and palbo, T4N2, and I guess she still has localized disease. I guess the question is, would you ever consider T-DXd? We had two cases. I think you were in San Antonio for one of them that we present of 90-year-olds who got dose reduced T-DXd and responded with metastatic disease. Any thoughts about this case that Smitha has?
Yeah,
she also says, what about Taxol RT, she says also, question mark.
Yeah, I mean, I think age is relative to comorbidities and health. So there are 90-year-old patients who can tolerate chemo just fine. But of course, you have to be careful and keep in mind the safety of the regimen you choose. If you're treating this patient as a metastatic patient, I think I would follow the label and first start something like capecitabine. If this patient is felt to be going to benefit from T-DXd, which is like a chemotherapy, then, you know, I would first start a chemotherapy. That is how it's FDA approved. And I would use capecitabine. You could add radiation therapy if the local disease is, not going well and the patient needs to be palliated with radiation. And if the patient's disease progresses on capecitabine, then yes, at that point, since you're treating as an unresectable locally advanced breast cancer, T-DXd would be appropriate.
So a couple other points about ADCs in general in terms of sort of how we see these agents moving forward. We are seeing data, for example, this paper we have up here from Cancer Discovery and many others on ADCs working in the brain. So it's another sort of concept, but also new agents coming along. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about Dato-DXd, same payload as Trastuzumab-DXd or T-DXd. But it looks like pretty interesting data coming out with ER-positive breast cancer in terms of response and tolerability. Any thoughts about this agent and other new ADCs coming into the breast cancer space?
Yeah, I agree. These data are quite intriguing. This is targeting TROP2, similar to the drug sacituzumab, but it has the DXd component. I agree the data are very interesting in triple negative breast cancer as well as hormone receptor positive breast cancer. So there are a number of phase 3 studies in the planning phase or an early startup looking at this agent. The toxicity profile is a little bit different from T-DXd. More mucositis has been reported. I actually had a patient enrolled on the triple negative component of the Tropion study who had disease progress on sacituzumab in the ASCENT trial, then hopped onto this trial and actually derived clinical benefit for some time with this, which sort of challenged my notion going into this that patients who were on one ADC with a similar payload wouldn't respond to another one and there would be cross resistance due to the mechanism of action of the payload. But I was wrong. So I think we're going to really have to see what the data shows in terms of whether we can sequence these agents.
Yeah, like I was saying there with the bladder cancer, the sacituzumab and fortumab, and incidentally, and fortumab just got approved with Pembro first line in bladder cancer. So now another ADC has moved up. So, there was another question I saw. Oh, yeah. Hassan has a patient with leptomeningeal disease with HER2 low, progressed on ribo, capecitabine, wants to know, do we have any? I was talking about brain mets. What about leptomeningeal disease and HER2 low, T-DXd, Sarah?
Not enough data, but I do want to underscore what you said earlier about the fact that we are seeing activity of ADCs in the central nervous system, which is challenging our paradigm thinking that bulky molecules can't cross the blood-brain barrier. We're seeing, you know, patients have real responses. The Tuxedo study showed a 75% response rate in about 15 patients with progressive HER2 positive CNS mets. So if the patient has LM disease and local therapies have been exhausted, you know, a trial of intrathecal chemo has not benefited the patient and there's extracranial disease that needs to be treated and their disease is HER2 low, I wouldn't hesitate to try T-DXd.
So it's always a temptation. I could spend the next hour just going through the chat room, but I'm going to hold off and we'll try to stick with the cases we presented, but we're going to try to include some of these ones that are coming in the chat room as we go along. But let's dive into some of these cases. I mentioned we've got about 12 of them, but we're going to start out with a premenopausal patient who has a small tumor, 0.8 centimeters, but 2 positive sentinel nodes. And the surgeon ordered an Oncotype, much to the oncologist's dismay, because she would have wanted to give chemo. And it's, as always, of course, and now it's low, so you don't know what to do. Here's Dr. Gupta.
48-year-old premenopausal woman who has grade 1, about 8 millimeters invasive, but 2 out of 2 sentinel lymph node positive. Recurrence score of 9. Don't know what to do. So I think those are the patients that are very confusing. I said in my view that I would not do the oncotype in this patient and offered chemotherapy, but it was already done, the oncotype. But I was thinking I would try to give ovarian suppression and then AI. One of my colleagues was arguing that he would have done the oncotype because, you know, that 9 would still make the decision not to give chemotherapy, while I and another one of my colleagues were saying that we would not do the oncotype and just offer them chemo.
So she actually got TC followed by LHRH plus AI. Any thoughts about this case and her questions?
Yeah, I think at least once a month we see a similar case like this come through our multi-tumor board. And I have to tell you, I agree. This is so challenging. We have the data from our responder telling us it doesn't matter what your recurrence score is. If you're premenopausal and you have 1 to 3 positive nodes, chemo will benefit you. But it just biologically doesn't make a lot of sense. And the problem is that our responder study didn't give ovarian suppression to patients. So we really can't know what the interaction is there. The challenge for me, because I would try to avoid chemo here, but the challenge for me is that there are patients who try ovarian suppression and cannot tolerate it. So if you're relying on ovarian suppression to replace chemotherapy, it may not be a safe bet because patients need to do that for 5 years. So I think a really intense discussion with the patient about what this means is important because we don't have good data one way or another.
The other issue that really even goes beyond chemo or not is you do an axillary node dissection to look at more nodes because now we have issues, you know, for example, CDK in the adjuvant setting. If you have more nodes, more likely to use it. And yet there was an editorial in the JCO, Sarah Tulaney and colleagues bringing this issue up, saying they're still not going to do node dissection just to get number of nodes. Here we have a patient with 2 sentinel nodes. Any thought about that issue?
Yeah, it's almost like the Ki-67 issue where you're forcing pathologists to do Ki-67 to meet the criteria to give adjuvant abemaciclib. And luckily, with the update from Monarchy at San Antonio, the FDA has altered its guidelines its approval of abemaciclib. I agree. I think it's going to be patient by patient situation. I don't think that it is right for a patient to be sent back to the OR to do additional dissection, given the morbidity of that and the unlikelihood that the dissection itself is going to impact their outcome. If they have high risk features, I would be inclined to offer abemaciclib. The other side of that, though, is insurance approval issues. And so I think these are very individualized cases that are going to require us to be strong advocates for our patients.
So oncologists are always presenting cases to me of premenopausal women. You know, there's a lot of questions about how to manage them in terms of, particularly as it relates to oncotype. And here's another case, a 42-year-old premenopausal patient of Dr. Leisure presents with a big tumor. Here's his questions.
It turns out she's probably going to have her surgery first. But I guess 2 questions. One is, if she really does have a tumor that's more than 5 centimeters, does she automatically need chemotherapy? Do we trust oncotype in tumors more than 5 centimeters? I think the other thing is, knowing that this tumor is large, I'm really thinking about ovarian suppression and aromatase inhibitor for her, not tamoxifen. But with the abemaciclib data out now, if we decided we were going to treat her neoadjuvantly, would you give her abemaciclib along with ovarian suppression and aromatase inhibitor as opposed to just an AI, or is there a role for fulvestrant?
Yeah. Any thoughts?
So simple.
It gets harder as you go along.
Oh, we're in trouble.
It's like the boards.
Yeah. So do we trust Oncotype in greater than 5 centimeters? Not a huge number of patients. I think we have to, I'd have to look at the subgroup analysis from Taylor X and other studies. I mean, I'm inclined to do surgery first here to get the nodal status and the true size of the tumor rather than neoadjuvant, unless I have a surgeon say, look, we can't do surgery now. There's no way we can get clear margins, even with mastectomy. Then our hands force. But with a grade 1 ERPR positive tumor, it's unlikely to get much of a response, regardless of what we give. We did give neoadjuvant Abema and endocrine therapy on the NeoMonarch study. The path CR rate was low, as it always is with any systemic therapy prior to surgery in this type of tumor. So I would do Oncotype if it was a node negative 5 centimeter tumor in a 42-year-old. I think it would be informative. If node positive, I think given the size, the node positivity, and the age of the patient, I'd be inclined to skip Oncotype and recommend chemo.
So I want to show some results from the survey we did of the faculty. And this is actually the third one of these webinars that we've done on this topic. And each one, I'm starting to get a stronger and stronger feeling about whether or not endocrine therapy in premenopausal women in the adjuvant setting, how it's being applied. We were talking in the last program, there was a big updated soft and text. Kathy Miller, who I think did the last one of these, did an editorial on that. And I don't see in that editorial, I don't see in the guidelines something that we found in terms of the question of, do you give tamoxifen when do you use tamoxifen alone as adjuvant therapy in premenopausal women? And the reverse side is, when are you going to use ovarian suppression and ablation? And well, before I show you the data, let me just ask you, would you agree that in general, the relative risk reduction when you use ovarian suppression ablation plus either tamoxifen or AI is going to be greater than tamoxifen alone? And the reason you don't use it in everybody is, as you get lower risk and the absolute benefit of tamoxifen or endocrine therapy decreases, now you have to encounter more quality of life issues, maybe even specific complications. So just from a risk-benefit point of view, it maybe is not worth doing. Is that principle, you think, the way we're thinking about it?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so here's what we found, which is, I mean, if you think about tamoxifen as endocrine therapy by itself, I think you're talking about node negative for sure. I mean, node positive, they're going to get chemo most likely, and they're even and ovarian suppression plus something else. But what we saw in node negative when we asked the faculty is whether or not they used tamoxifen alone was heavily affected by recurrence score, as it makes sense. And in general, what we're starting to see is when investigators are going to use chemo, and a lot of that has to do with recurrence score, they're going to use ovarian suppression and ablation. I don't see that in the guidelines. And that's just like what you all are doing. And maybe it's not scientifically perfect evidence, but there it is. We say recurrence score 8, and you see a number of people bringing up tamoxifen. Some, Kathy, for example, are still saying AI because you are going to get a little bit greater effect. But then you bump it up to 20, and nobody's saying tamoxifen. And so any thoughts about that, and positive node also, you see not only the issue of chemotherapy, regardless of recurrence score, but again, a lot of use of ovarian suppression and ablation. Any thoughts about this? And are we underutilizing ovarian suppression?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is the gut response based on sort of summarizing the data in one's brain when we are lacking solid evidence to guide us. And I do think we are heavily influenced by the recurrence score when we're weighing whether or not to use ovarian suppression in our patients going on endocrine therapy. I know I am in practice. If I have a low recurrence score and a node negative tumor, I'm going to be very comfortable with tamoxifen. But once we get a node involved, that's additional information that impacts our use of ovarian suppression. And if we have a higher Oncotype recurrence score, that's certainly going to influence in clinical practice. It doesn't appear in the guidelines because we don't have level 1 evidence. We don't have yet, and there will be data in the future telling us how to sort out benefit from chemo versus benefit from ovarian suppression, and you know whether endocrine therapy alone without ovarian suppression is sufficient in certain patients based on recurrence score. So we're kind of all using it at this point, assuming we know what the answer is. Often we're right, sometimes we're wrong, which is why we need to do the studies ultimately.
So, yeah, that's our way of doing consensus is if everybody says the same thing, we call it a consensus. If they don't, then it's not. But just to finish out, there's so much attention been on Oncotype and premenopausal, just to kind of make sure we know where we're at in postmenopausal. So we say here a patient who's 65 with one positive node, low recurrence score, nobody's given chemo. And even recurrence score 20, nobody's given chemo. We say three positive nodes, same thing. So that's to me, that was the main, even though everybody's talking about premenopausal, that was the most important thing about our responder. That's where most of the patients are. Any comments?
Yeah, I think it's really cool to see that people are at least in this group of people polled applying the data from our responder and not utilizing chemo in our women who are postmenopausal with up to three nodes. I saw a patient this week, however, of a grade one invasive lobular tumor with seven positive nodes. It was only a 1.8 centimeter tumor, but they were shocked when they went to surgery. It was seven positive nodes. But it was grade one invasive lobular. We know that, and the recurrence score was 10. So can we then extrapolate to more than three positive nodes in this woman who is in her 60s? This is where, again, we enter a data-free zone. And I think I and the other oncologists who saw her were tempted to use all that information, including the recurrence score, to lean away from the use of chemotherapy.
I was just thinking about this way of doing sort of consensus. And you look at this slide and you go, well, what's the best AI to use? This is a perfect example of a coin flip. Just ask me, half the people say one, half say the other. What about the issue of using ovarian suppression for fertility preservation? We did a whole program with Kathy and Ann Partridge about premenopausal patients. The other thing they brought up was not just fertility preservation, but preserving ovarian function so you don't have premenopausal issues. So when we say ER positive, HER2 negative, most of the faculty will use this during chemotherapy to preserve both for fertility as well as ovarian. When we say HER2 positive, kind of similar answers. And I think that, we had triple negative. Oh, no, I guess I skipped the triple negative. But anyhow, same thing. Any comments about your current use of LHRH during chemotherapy for these two purposes?
Yeah, so for ovarian function preservation, I think, to be honest, when I read it, I was reading it as ovarian function suppression, because I will see this as both preserving fertility, but also getting a head start on the OFS needed when we add in endocrine therapy later. And then if they're young enough and are going to complete their endocrine therapy and be able to have children, then, you know, it likely improves fertility preservation. So I wasn't thinking about, I guess the fertility preservation and ovarian function preservation are somewhat synonymous to me. I know they lead to different endpoints, but I think I was reading it more of OFS.
Right. And any comments about this other, you know, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time because we've already talked a lot about the issue of choice of CDK inhibitors, as long as we're talking about hormonal therapy in the metastatic setting. We have seen the beginnings of a shift towards ribo because of the survival data. Here you see some of that, not 100%. You're one of the ribo people. I guess just go with the data.
That's where I am. I mean, palbo's whole history began at UCLA. So it's we've done studies with all of them. I think palbo may be the best tolerated, to be honest, in my experience. Abema probably the least tolerated. And ribo has hit that sweet spot of hitting overall survival endpoint in at least 3 randomized clinical trials now, I think that's really compelling, whereas, you know, Palbo has not. So that's the underlying reason for my answers.
So we're going to talk about oral SERDs. Now we have one, elacestrant, that's approved in patients with ESR1 mutated breast cancer. We asked the faculty, of course, everybody's on board, but has different ways they think this through. How are you thinking through the use of this agent, and what situations are you using it now?
I'm using it after the CDK4/6 inhibitor and endocrine therapy, and I also feel that dual targeted therapy, meaning endocrine therapy plus a PI3 kinase pathway inhibitor, likely benefits patients more than single agent endocrine therapy. So I would position this in the third line setting in a patient having an ESR1 mutation.
So a lot of times nowadays we're talking about press releases. We learn about trials before we actually see the data. This one just came out from the NATALEE trial, a second phase 3 study showing benefit in the adjuvant setting of a CDK inhibitor, in this case ribociclib. Hopefully, maybe we'll see this at ASCO, or hopefully we'll see it soon. Of course, we need to see the data. Any thoughts about how this is going to affect practice? We're already seeing a lot of Abema being used. Do you think this is going to end up being sort of a coin flip, hard to figure out what to use? Well, we need to see the data, but any thoughts about where this is going to lead?
There are a couple of things that distinguish this study. First of all, the ribo is given for 3 years, whereas with Abema, it was 2 years. It's a lower dose of ribo than we're using in the metastatic setting, which will hopefully mitigate that QTC issue and reduce the need for us to follow EKGs. And also, this study included a medium risk population of patients, so it's not just for high risk patients. And then finally, I think ribo on a day-to-day basis is a bit better tolerated than Abema. So it may be that we have 2 choices and we have to sort through the side effect profile, concomitant medications, and relative benefits of these 2 agents when we decide.
So getting so many great questions and comments in the chat room. Dr. Kumar has a patient who had 9 positive nodes, ER positive, been on an AI for 10 years, now actually 15 years. We have a case, if we get to it, if a patient's been on it for 16 years, keep it going. He wants to know.
Oh, that's such an important question that we just don't know. I mean, I suppose what we do in these situations when we have a ton of lymph nodes involved is we're considering these patients to already have stage 4 disease, and we're keeping it below the level of clinical detection with the use of prolonged therapy. And I have done this in a few patients with a ton of nodes involved. I think, again, it's looking at the risk-benefit analysis. How are the patient's bones holding up? How are the side effects? What does their cardiac profile look like? Lipids, et cetera. We don't have data beyond 10 years at this point, so we're sort of off the reservation doing this, but in some patients, I think it's a reasonable approach.
So one more chat room, I can't resist it, from Danny, wants to know, would you combine elacestrant with a CDK inhibitor in the second line setting?
I would not combine any of the investigational oral SERDs or elacestrant, which is now approved, outside of a clinical trial. There may be interactions that affect the level of either of the drugs in the blood and may affect the safety. So I would be very cautious about doing something like that. And although we're all tempted to do it, I would strongly advise against it.
So before we get into another case, this is a fantastic paper you and your colleague Dr. Zhang did on Oncotype in premenopausal women. But actually, it's a fantastic review article in general on Oncotype. I mean, there's a long lot of stuff in there, really great. Incidentally, you have this paper. I love this thing, the history of Oncotype. Over there on the left, under 2004, quick story, we were at the San Antonio meeting in 2004. I was doing an interview with Dan Hayes, and he says, you need to go find this pathologist with the NSABP named Soon Paik and do an interview with him. So I found him, interviewed him, and of course, he told me the story of what he was about to present. amazing when you think back at that point, anybody with a tumor over one centimeter was getting adjuvant chemo. So what an amazing impact this has had. And I love these graphics. I'm not even going to get into this, your algorithm, just to ask people to please take a look at the paper. It's an awesome paper. We also put in the slide deck a bunch of papers about ongoing trials looking at oral SERDs that you might want to check out. Here, one that actually is no longer going to be available, amcenestrant, because of the lack of benefit that was seen. Again, there's some great graphics in these papers about how these drugs work. We're not going to go into all the details. What about camizestrin? And in general, what's the difference between the oral SERDs? Is it going to be a kind of Me Too situation, whoever has the data? We saw, you know, some pretty interesting data from this Serena 2 trial at San Antonio.
Yeah, the Serena 2 study, I think, was, you know, a mood lifter for a lot of us because we had just come off seeing or hearing about negative data relating to amcenestrin. And people began to worry, is you know, all of the hype around oral SERDs overdone? And then Serena was presented, and it was a nice positive study, shows really what appears to be reasonable safety. And so we have the second oral SERD that it does appear to be effective. And of course, we have a number of ongoing studies looking at alternative agents that target estrogen receptor in ER-positive tumors. So I think it's an exciting time. We don't have any head-to-head comparisons among these various agents. So we're having to do sort of in the back of our mind a cross-trial comparison among these agents, which isn't fair. A lot of them will cause some nausea, some cause bradycardia. We have to watch for drug-drug interactions, so we have to be careful about that. And I think as you analyze these studies, it's important not to compare the efficacy of one versus the other, since trials have different enrollment criteria. Some studies are allowing more heavily pretreated patients. Some are really focusing in on ESR1 mutated tumors. So those sorts of nuances can affect what the efficacy looks like. And I would just advise everybody to look at these drugs individually, based on the studies that are presented, rather than comparing one to the other until an actual comparison's done.
I was just flashing on the fact that it wasn't that long ago that when we were doing HER2 programs, we were going, it's a shame there's not as much to talk about in ER-positive breast cancer. Now, like, we're still haven't even got through it. I mean, we could spend 2 hours just on ER-positive, which is such a great development because that's where the patients are. And speaking of that, of course, I've got to ask you about capivasertib. Boom, we saw a phase three style trial that followed this initial phase two study, the Capitella 291 study presented at San Antonio. Any thoughts about this agent? Would you like to have it available now? And in what situations would you be using it?
Yeah, it's a very exciting AKT inhibitor, and we saw some very exciting data relating to it from the FACTION study. These phase three data, of course, provided more validation of those data and demonstrated that patients who had up to two prior lines of endocrine therapy for advanced disease, up to one prior chemo, and about half or more of the patients had a prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. Patients benefited in terms of a strong benefit with respect to progression-free survival, a trend toward improved overall survival. And in my opinion, again, it's not fair. I just told everyone not to do cross-trial comparisons, but I was intrigued that the safety profile seems to look better than it did for alpelisib. Although there was diarrhea and rash and hyperglycemia, the severity was much lower than we've seen with other trials of PI3 kinase inhibitors. And the benefits of this drug were seen regardless of whether the tumor had PI3 kinase pathway activation via PIK3CA mutation or AKT mutation. So yeah, this could be a drug that can be utilized the way that we utilize Everolimus in all patients with ER-positive breast cancer.
So, and I guess it's being looked at in the first-line setting, or at least then it's combined with fulvestrant and palbo. We'll see how that goes in terms of tolerability, seems like. I mean, fulvestrant and palbo is certainly well-tolerated, so you would imagine this. We'll see what efficacy. All right, let's talk a little bit more about HER2-low. Dr. Chen has a 70-year-old lady who's currently getting T-DXd. She's not sure what to do now and what to do next because some of the lesions are responding and some are progressing. Here's Dr. Chen.
This is a very nice 70-year-old woman. Clinically, she's doing okay. She does have a mild pleural effusion, and she has the bone knee metastasis, and she also has cutaneous metastasis. So she has wounds which she's cared for by wound clinic. Her most recent PET-CT does show a mixed response with it, improving some of the sites and progressing other sites. Since she's tolerating this well, we're continuing her on the febtrostuzumab, but certainly the question is, what will be the next treatment for her? Since she had shortness of breath because she has the mediastinal adenopathy and she has been, you know, on and off oxygen in the past. I would be interested to know in terms of the follow-up for patients on febtrostuzumab in terms of how frequently to image to look for interstitial lung disease or what other workup we should do for interstitial lung disease.
And I was mentioning the ONS Congress that we're going to. We're actually doing a program. As a matter of fact, your colleague Zev Weinberg in GI is going to be there. We're doing a program on HER2 across tumor types. So we have GI, lung, and breast. We're going to try to talk about them all together. And of course, the lung people, you know, were HER2 mutant, but the lung people have a lot of patients with pre-existing pulmonary problems. This patient has a pulmonary symptomatology from the cancer, which, you know, it's interesting how you approach trying to pick up ILD in a patient like that. Any thoughts about this case? What you might be thinking about next is the patient clearly does have progression. Why you think you might see a mixed response? You think it might have something to do with HER2 expression? Any thoughts?
Yeah, so in terms of monitoring for the ILD, we don't think that the presence of pulmonary metastases causes an increase or elevates the risk of ILD, but it, as you mentioned, it can make it more difficult to discern is ILD occurring. I, in my practice, tend to follow the scans every 9 weeks or so, the chest CT. Sometimes you'll have a patient who's responded so beautifully, you're tempted to start doing Q3 to 4 month CTs to follow the disease. But with the lung, I do CT scans. We could even do a low-dose CT of the chest just to keep an eye on the lungs because ILD can occur even after a year of being on therapy, so it's important. In terms of progression, I think there's a lot of work being done now to identify pathways of resistance, and it may come down to loss of expression of the target antigen, but there could either also be other mechanisms. And for this particular patient, I can't recall if the patient had hormone receptor co-expression, but we do have sacituzumab govitecan as an available agent now for hormone receptor positive breast cancer based on TROPiCS-02. That might be something to be considered, although the payloads are fairly similar. And again, sequencing these agents one after the other and the efficacy of doing that is not entirely understood at this point.
And actually, Kamal in the chat room brings up the possibility of sacituzumab in a patient like this with HER2-low disease. Been a big debate ever since the HER2-low data came out about, I guess, hormone receptor negative, you know, HER2-low, formerly triple negative. What comes first, sacituzumab or T-DXd? Any general thoughts about that?
It's a huge area of controversy, and the way I sort of address this is the side effect profiles, essentially. Some of my patients will do as much as they can to avoid full alopecia. Sacituzumab has full alopecia, T-DXd does not. Some patients are very worried about the risk of ILD. Sacituzumab doesn't have that as much. Sacituzumab has more diarrhea and T-DXd has more nausea. I think the data for both agents are quite compelling, and we don't have a head-to-head comparison of them. However, one needs to keep in mind that the ASCENT study was a trial that enrolled all patients had triple-negative disease, whereas in DESTINY-Breast03, only about 10% of the patients had hormone receptor-negative disease. So we don't have the same level of evidence supporting T-DXd here. All that said, TDXD did perform beautifully in the patients with triple negative breast cancer in DESTINY-Breast03. So I think it's a reasonable option to consider.
So I like to brag we have the best chat room in the business. Here's another quick one from Fadi. What comes first, CAPI or elacestrant in ESR, assuming you could get CAPI in ESR1 mutant patients?
All these questions that are so tough to answer. In my opinion, if CAPI is available, FDA approved, I would use it first. Again, I think the PFS we see with dual targeting, meaning targeting PI3 kinase pathway and the hormone pathway together, gets you longer PFS than doing single agent endocrine therapy. So I would sequence it that way.
So maybe we'll come back to some more of the chat room in a second, but let's keep going because I want to bring in another topic, PARP inhibitors. So Dr. Lamar has a 48-year-old woman. This is, you know, Hal Burstein always says, I make up these scenarios, you know, they never happen. Anyhow, she's got a patient with who's got a BRCA mutation and triple negative disease who's getting KEYNOTE-522. Here are her questions.
48-year-old who was diagnosed with multicentric right-sided triple negative breast cancer. I treated her per KEYNOTE-522 with pembrolizumab, carboplatin, and paclitaxel, followed by AC. During the course of treatment, she was found to be BRCA1 positive. With neoadjuvant treatment, she achieved a complete response. In patients who have received treatment per KEYNOTE-522, in the adjuvant setting, do you continue pembrolizumab, particularly for those patients who have achieved a complete response? Now, my patient did not have residual disease, but in a patient with residual disease who was also BRCA positive, how do you approach these patients?
Any thoughts?
Great questions. I definitely continue the pembrolizumab in the patients, regardless of whether they've achieved a path CR, because the KEYNOTE study was designed that way. And there's still a trend toward a better outcome with the use of pembrolizumab in those patients who do have a path CR. We don't have studies showing that you can have the same benefit by omitting the maintenance pembrolizumab. The only place where I've not done that is if I have a significant adverse event, immune-related adverse event. If the patient had residual disease, I feel fairly comfortable, again, outside of standard practice or guidelines, but I would feel comfortable utilizing a olaparib as per the Olympiad study in patients and use it with the pembrolizumab. I think, the combination should be relatively safe and I would feel comfortable doing that.
So another PARP question, PALB2, we talk about it. Well, here it is, 50-year-old premenopausal patient of Dr. Mitchell. Here's the case.
Not only does she have bilateral disease, she had bilateral node-positive disease with extensive involvement, but she had no evidence of metastatic disease. So she was treated with adjuvant chemotherapy because of the number of lymph nodes she had. I think she had over 4 on one side and I think over 6 on the other. It was pretty impressive. She had like T3 and 1. T2N2. The other issue is, how does PALB2 play into this? Because olaparib does have activity for PALB2 germline mutation disease as well, is my understanding. We know that platinums have a lot of activity. And, I would love to ask, where do we start with this lady?
Would you start?
Yeah, so it's ERPR positive, and with the PALB2 mutation, so it's bilateral cancer with bilateral positive nodes. So I think the patient does deserve chemotherapy. We don't always do that in ER positive, but with positive nodes in her age, I would certainly do that. And I would utilize a platinum-based regimen here. I would definitely feel comfortable utilizing olaparib. Patients with PALB2 mutations weren't allowed in the Olympia study, but it is something that I think, given the way that PALB2 mutations work, so similarly to BRCA 1 and 2, I would feel comfortable doing that to improve her outcomes.
So any comments about how the Olympia has been playing out in your practice and also how olaparib is tolerated in your experience in the adjuvant setting? Of course, you have the issue of GI issues and also cytopenias. What have you seen?
So the GI issues, in my opinion, are the most bothersome to patients, notably nausea. So patients need to have antiemetics available at home and need to, you know, sometimes I've had to dose reduce actually therapy to help them. These are patients who have universally already had chemo and they're fairly tired of the side effects from systemic therapy. So I've had to do a lot more hand holding in the adjuvant setting with patients going on olaparib.
So here are a couple questions we asked the faculty in our survey. Somatic BRCA. In general, people view that the same as germline, same thing that we've heard from the GYN people. Germline, PALB2, most people haven't seen it. That's why I was so excited to present this case. This patient actually had. But again, most people consider it in the same manner as the others. I'm just going to skip through these. What about in metastatic disease in terms of choice of agent? We have two there. You say either one, other people favor olaparib, maybe because they have more experience with it. Any differentiating factors between the two, hair loss?
I haven't seen differences in hair loss. I've seen more anemia with talazoparib, maybe a little bit more nausea with olaparib. There hasn't been a head-to-head comparison, and I think you hit it spot on. People are comfortable with what they've worked with, and given the availability of olaparib in the curative setting, I think we have a whole bunch of people who are comfortable utilizing olaparib. Tala is only available in the metastatic setting.
So Ikiwacha says, would you use a PARP inhibitor in a patient who ran out of all other options but had a BRCA of variant of unknown significance?
I wouldn't place a lot of faith the benefits of PARP inhibition in patients with a VUS and BRCA, no.
All right, let's do some rapid rounds here. We have a few other cases just to kind of get your top line thoughts. 36-year-old woman diagnosed with breast cancer, 18 weeks pregnant, oncotype 17. Here's Dr. Astrow.
She came to me 18 weeks pregnant, grade 2 infiltrating ductal, two separate areas of cancer, 15 millimeters, 13 millimeters, ERPR positive, HER2 negative, Ki-67, 20%, oncotype 17. She's 36. So there are a number of different issues here. First, she wants to continue the pregnancy. There's just no question. So then what do I do? You can't give a hormonal agent to a pregnant woman, whereas you can give chemotherapy. You just wait. How safe is that for the woman? I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm giving her four cycles of AC, which she started at week 20. I'm giving it to her every 3 weeks.
So we really appreciate so much that docs will put their practice out there in front of us for people to take a look at. It's so helpful to hear real cases. A lot of times when the investigator goes, I don't know what to do either, it makes everybody feel better. But any thoughts about this?
Yeah, I think that Dr. Astrow has handled this perfectly. We do have a good amount of safety supporting the use of AC during pregnancy based on patients who are diagnosed with leukemia or lymphoma, which is life-threatening during pregnancy. And it's pretty safe to give. And we have mounting data relating to the safety even of a paclitaxel. I agree with the Q3 weekly dose that he chose so that you don't have to use growth factors. And of course, you can't use endocrine therapy for this particular patient. I wouldn't have qualms about using chemo in spite of her oncotype score of 17, given this very unique situation in which she finds herself.
So I know the audience, a lot of our audiences use entrectinib, but I'm not sure you have. Anyhow, have you incidentally? Okay, well, here it is. 49-year-old woman, ERPRP. And this is really the benefit of getting NGS, though. You know, you had another paper we didn't talk about where you looked at NGS and premenopausal women. I really recommend that one as well. Anyhow, 49-year-old patient of Dr. Gosain.
Got a biopsy and sent it for NGS. She was PIK3CA negative. So we started her on everolimus and fulvestrant. She further progressed And this time it was liver lesions that were rapidly progressing. Looking in her NGS, she also had NTRK mutation. With her recent progression on capecitabine, I've started her on NTRK inhibitor. It's been about 2 months. She also has 3 brain lesions. She got SBRT for all 3 of them. She's asymptomatic with her brain lesions. She's on NTRK inhibitor at this time. At what point do you consider NTRK inhibitor in someone like breast cancer? Is there data that this also crosses the blood-brain barrier? She's doing remarkably well right now. Where do the faculty members consider NTRK inhibitors for breast cancer when you have so many different multiple lines of treatment that you could play around with?
And I think actually NTRK in lung cancer does have good CNS penetration, better than crizotinib, or I think in ROS1. Any thoughts about this case?
Yeah, I would be so excited to find an NTRK fusion. I have still not encountered that in my clinical practice, and we do a lot of next-gen sequencing. I think I applaud his use of it after everolimus fulvestrant. I think patients have a higher likelihood of benefiting from therapies used earlier line setting. Moreover, this is a targeted therapy for her particular disease. So why delay it for some chemotherapy that is less targeted to the biology of the particular tumor? So I think, you know, I wouldn't place it above a CDK4/6 inhibitor, but certainly before going to chemotherapy, if you've discovered it, I think it's worthwhile to consider using it.
So we just did a big endometrial cancer program at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting where they had 2 gigantic phase 3 trials looking at MSI high endometrial and MSI stable. Curious, have you seen MSI high breast cancer?
I have not personally. I've seen a patient who had a tumor mutational burden that was relatively high, and we used pembrolizumab, but it was very, very late setting and didn't see a response. But again, it's something we evaluate for in all of these patients, and it's relatively uncommon to find.
So yeah, there's some great stories that come out when you find it, as everybody in the audience knows. Well, here's another case. Actually, I see Dr. McKenna in the chat room. So she's got, this is what I was talking about before, 63-year-old lady who presented in 2006. We were just talking about Oncotype was first presented 2004. So she was one of the early beneficiaries. She actually had metaplastic breast cancer, which I don't know anything about, but an Oncotype of 51. Here's Dr. McKenna.
63-year-old, she was diagnosed in 2006 with metaplastic breast cancer that I knew nothing about at that time. 1.2 centimeters, node negative, LVI positive, grade 3. The ER was 20% and PR low. Oncotype value was 51, was off the chart. She underwent surgery and then 6 cycles of TAC, local radiation. Anastrozole started in December 2006, had severe tendinitis, and strangely, switching her to letrozole worked because, you know, letrozole causes a greater reduction in estrogens than does anastrozole. So the questions I had was with her, she's been on an AI for 16 years. She's an engineer, as is her husband, and she's not had any side effects, and she's very afraid to stop her letrozole. So is it wrong on my part to continue the AI? And what is the natural history in this treated lady with metaplastic breast cancer? The other question was, with her low ER, am I fooling myself using an AI?
And, you know, also high Oncotype, I'm not sure how does that reflect on, you know, endocrine responsiveness. Any comments about metaplastic breast cancer? Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah. They tend to be more sarcoma-like, triple negative, more locally aggressive rather than distant metastases. I think this patient, in my opinion, is likely cured if it was truly a metaplastic cancer. That low expression of ER, I think, and I think it was lack of PR probably drove up the Oncotype score. I would have probably used an AI similar to what she did just to cover my bases in case there was heterogeneity in the histology of the tumor. I would probably get a second opinion pathologist at the time to confirm it's metaplastic and not a poorly differentiated IDC, but I don't really believe that there is additional benefit by being out 16 years and continuing it, other than maybe the benefit of reducing the risk of a new breast cancer and remaining breast tissue. But I even beyond 5 years, we don't have good data to support that. So I think I would probably stop the anti-estrogen therapy.
So another case from the chat room from Hassan, 30-year-old pregnant patient, 22 weeks, inflammatory cancer, large nodes, triple negative, ? Approach to therapy. Can you use an IO during pregnancy?
No, I would never, I would not use immune therapy during pregnancy. This is somebody I would use anthracycline-based therapy and consider taxane depending. You know, hopefully you could do the anthracycline and get her to a delivery and then give the taxane platinum, and you can do immune therapy at that time after delivery.
So Sarah, thank you so much for working with us on this program. So exciting in breast cancer, so exciting in oncology in general. Really looking forward to seeing what's going to happen. Hopefully at ASCO, we'll see. Maybe we're going to have another CDK available in the adjuvant setting. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back tomorrow night, we'll see what Dr. Pazares and Dr. Wakely have to say about immunotherapy of lung cancer, particularly in the early stage setting. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks.
Take care.